chapter 5. That's our passage this morning, just seven verses, verses 1 to 7. We've been journeying over the past 4 weeks with the teacher, this teacher who has come with some honest struggles. He's been asking some of those big, big questions. You know the questions that average people like you and I, we sort of retreat back from a little bit. We hesitate to push those questions too far. The big existential questions, the why. You know, is there meaning, is there purpose in anything that I do? You and I are often willing to take those questions to a certain point, but we tend to retreat back a little bit because we're afraid of what lies on the other side. So we avoid those questions. We self-medicate. We distract ourselves. We amuse ourselves with other things because we know that if we ever sat there quietly, those questions would gnaw at us. There's this gnawing sense when we're honest that no matter what we do, even good pursuits in themselves are, as the teacher says, vanity. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. That no matter what we do, at the end of the day, we have this gnawing sickness that makes us feel like if there is any meaning to any of it, it's completely unknowable. And so the teacher says that all of life's pursuits are like striving after wind. Have you ever tried to chase wind? It's in vain. It's like striving after wind. It's impossible. It's a task that you can't do. I like the other analogy that he uses to describe this. He says, all of the rivers flow into the seas, but the seas never fill up. Isn't that a picture of life sometimes? That's the way that I feel every week when I do the laundry. Every week I do the laundry and I turn around twice as soon as the underwear is all neatly folded in our drawers and I go back and in the clothes hamper there's more. It's just this incessant, never-ending vanity. Why do I even bother doing laundry? I just go to Walmart and buy more underwear. We can all relate to the teacher as he comes to this and he says, all of my pursuits are vanity, so I tried them all. We saw as he said, I'm going to try big pimping. I'm going to go out and I'm going to pursue all the pleasure that I can. I'm going to download the Tinder app on my phone and see if that gives me fulfillment. Didn't work. Vanity of vanities, it turns to ash in his mouth. He says, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to laugh really hard and just enjoy humor. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to binge watch Netflix, Arrested Development. He goes, well, that didn't work either. I still feel empty and hollow. It feels like it's all pointless and meaningless. So he says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to throw myself into my career, into my job. I'm going to make a whole bunch of money so that I can build a house with a swimming pool in the backyard. He goes, man, even that feels empty and hollow. Because at the end of the day, I just have to leave it to my snotty-nosed kids. Doesn't matter what I do, everything feels empty and hollow. He says in chapter 3, one of the most biting things, he says, both man and beast end up in the same place. So why do I even bother? Someday I'm going to die. So what do? Do you just live a life of despair and vanity? Do you live a life of meaninglessness? Well, absolutely not. We come to chapter 5 this morning and the text shifts. Did you feel that when it was being read, when Robin Lynn was reading it? It sounds different. We've come to approximately the middle point of the book, and when it was being read, you can feel this shift from a laundry list of vanities to clear warning on how we deal with God. That's what's happened in chapter 5. But I want to suggest to you this morning that this part of chapter 5 is not fundamentally just about how we deal with God. It's deeper than that. The teacher wants us to consider how we think about God. What do we think about him? And what do we think about ourselves? Who is God? And who am I in this world that he's created? Because if you get those two things straight, you may be beginning to unlock a life of meaning and purpose. Chapter 5 gives us insight. I want to suggest to you this morning that chapter 5 shows us that there are two things that rob us of a life of meaning. The first one is when we try to be God. When we try to be God. And the second one is when we try to make God into someone like us. So let's dive in. The first one, when I think that I am God, I am destined to live a life that is vanity and empty and meaningless. The teacher's journey so far has been marked by the first person personal pronoun. Do you know what I mean by that? They don't teach this stuff in school anymore. He says everything. He begins every sentence up to this point by saying, I have searched. I have found. Every time that I look, I find. All me, all the time. The point of this is that when you live in a me-centered universe, all me, all the time, you find that it's hollow and void of meaning. There's some deeper truth at work here. It's a deep truth that I experienced the very first time that I held Matthew. I held my son in my hands, my newborn baby son, and in that moment, it was the first time, if I'm honest, that I ever realized that my life was about something other than me. That I was actually not at the center of the universe. Matthew is. Ask him. He'll tell you. No, but you get what I mean. We live our lives as though we are the only thing that matters. That we are at the center of the universe. But then we have these moments where we catch the deep magic of the cosmos and we realize, actually, wait a second. My life has greater meaning and greater purpose when it's not all about me. I think holding a newborn baby gives you that insight and gives you that moment. There's something profoundly affirming and dignifying when you seek out moments wherein you feel small. Do you know what I mean by that? That's why people climb mountains. You stand at the top of a mountain after sweating. You stand there and you look out over the vastness and you feel so puny and tiny. It feels right because somehow you're finding your right place. You're not at the center of everything. It's moments when you look up at the night sky and you see infinite stars. And every one of those stars is a potential solar system just like our own. And you begin to feel small. You begin to realize that we're on a pale blue dot, as Carl Sagan said. We're floating on the outside. We're at the center of nothing. And yet we're at the center of God's plans. You see, when the entire cosmos is only just ever about me, then life is small and meaningless. It's limited and pathetic. If the entire world is just about me, then life is in vain. But if there's more, if I'm not at the center of the universe, then I'm beginning to glimpse a great truth. You see, the truth is that there is a cosmic throne and that my bum has no place on it. Do you know what I mean by that? I'm not at the center of the universe. There is a God, and I'm not him. That's what verse 3 says. Chapter 5, verse 3 says, God is in heaven. I'm here on earth. Stop flapping my gums at him as though I'm God. Right? Stop trying to tell him what to do. It's something that we often say, but I shudder every time that I hear it or I say it. If I were God, I would. Well, you guys can all be thankful that I'm not God. And I'm thankful that you're not. But that's how we treat God. You know, we treat him as though we are God and master and he's our servant. We treat him like a heavenly butler, not a heavenly father. We're like, God, need some help over here, right? Like we are at the center of the universe. Like the entire story of the entire cosmos is all about me, my comfort, my preferences, what I need. We live as though we are God. And so our lives feel meaningless and empty. We have to reorient our lives. I want you to notice that the struggle in Ecclesiastes is not the struggle of atheism. It's not that he doesn't believe in God. It's a struggle of secular humanism, to use another terminology. This is the struggle of a person who starts his thinking from himself and from the observable world and only knows God from a distance. It's the struggle of someone who's put their bum on the throne. A lot of us live like that. You know, we come to church, we teach in the Sunday school, we call ourselves Christians, but at the end of the day, there's very little about our lives that would lead an outside observer to conclude that we believe in a God who created everything and holds sway over his creation. We act functionally as though we are God. There's very little about our lives that points to the fact that there is a God and we're not him, other than the fact that we wake up early on Sunday mornings and pull out of the driveway with neatly dressed kids. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 suggests that the path to a meaningful life begins when we dethrone ourselves from the seat that belongs only to God. When we reorient our lives. He is God in heaven. I'm here on earth. There is a God, and I'm not him. God and his plans are at the center of the cosmos. And I find meaning and purpose that's rich and deep and abiding when I pray, thy will be done. Not my will be done. When I get that relationship right, when I say, you're God, I'm not. My words will be few. Do what you will. I trust you. Amen. Instead of trying to negotiate God into a box or a corner wherein he has to carry out my will. Friends, it's a struggle that's as old as time. Adam and Eve wanted to be God, and so they died like beasts. And you and I struggle with that all the time, too. When we try to be gods ourselves, we find that life is in vain. It's like striving after wind. The second thing that prevents us from having this meaningful life or discovering meaning in life is when I try to make God look like me. You see how that's slightly different? In the first case, I try to be God. In the second case, I try to make a God who's fashioned after me. I heard this story of this grade 3 class where a girl was diligently drawing on her piece of paper, and the teacher looked over and said, Sally, what are you drawing? And the little girl, without even lifting up her head, said very sincerely, oh, teacher, I'm drawing a picture of God. And the teacher said, oh, Sally, nobody knows what God looks like. To which the girl replied, they will in a minute. Right? It's a silly little story, but it's true. We're all like this grade 3 girl who fashions God in our own image. God creates human beings. We're told in Genesis 1, that God creates human beings in his image, and we spend the rest of our life trying to return the favor. We try to fashion God like ourselves, and so we end up creating this tame pal of a God. Dorothy Sayers, an author that some of you may know of from her mystery novels, she said that our great sin is that we have declawed the Lion of Judah and turned him into a pussycat for pale priests and pious old ladies. We try to take God and we try to fashion him in our own image. We try to make him like me. We try to make him a God who is easy to manage and deal with. We're in control. We make him like us. We try to make him into a God who would never ask from us what we don't want to give. We try to make him into a God who will always do what we think is fit and just. In essence, we try to make a God in our own image. Verses 4 to 7 deal with temple worship, and that's really what's going on here. It says, when you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It's better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Let not your mouth lead you into a sin, and do not say before the messenger that was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity, but God is the one you must fear. Here's what's going on. The teacher says, when you go to the temple, you're trying to cut deals with God. You're trying to interact with him and treat him as your equal. So this is what it sounds like. People would go to the temple and they'd say, God, if you do what I think you should do, if you behave like a God who's fashioned in my image, then I will offer a sacrifice of a goat. Well, sometimes it would work out. And then the people would say, yeah, you know that whole thing about offering the goat? Changed my mind on that one, God, but thanks anyway. The teacher wants you to know that this problem of treating God like he's created in our image is at the root of it all. Is God just a person like you and me? Is he my equal? Is he one with whom I can trifle? Verse 7, no. God is the one you must fear. God is the one you must fear. Fear God. Well, if it's beyond my pay grade to try to fashion a God in my own image, then I have to ask the question, what does he look like? What's God actually like? If I don't get to shape him and form him, what's he really like? Well, you have to look at how he reveals himself in the scriptures. And I think that's where it rubs for us. Because some of the passages that we read where God's revealing his character, those fit for us. We sit through and we say, yeah, if I was making a God, that's exactly how he would act. But then there are the other ones that don't. And that's where we have to say, he gets to be God. I don't get to shape and form him in my image. There are two dominant pictures that came to my mind this week when I was thinking about the nature and the character of God. If he's one to be feared, what's he like? Well, in the Old Testament, we're told that just the fullness of his manifest presence in a room was enough to knock people over dead. That if you came into his presence fully and unwithdrawn, you were knocked over dead instantly. So should you fear him? Well, I mean, don't be afraid of him, but kind of fear him, right? He's God of the universe. He makes everything. He's all powerful. That's one picture. But at the same time, in the New Testament, he reveals himself as the baby in the manger. He's the God whose manifest presence will slay you and kill you, but he's also the God who, when he takes human form, he doesn't come as a powerful Roman senator. He comes as a baby in a manger to an unwed teenaged mom, who then ultimately reveals who he is by going to the cross and dying for you. That's what he's like. And I think somehow, whatever else he is, we have to be able to hold those two things together. We don't get to decide what he's like. I think chapter 5 tells us that a meaningful life begins when we realize that God is not one that we get to reshape and reform into our own image. The creature isn't allowed to recreate the creator. You make something out of plasticine, the plasticine isn't allowed to come back and boss you around. Right? You build something out of Lego, the Legos have no rights to tell you how you should be. We're not dealing with an equal when we come to God. Now, I was realizing this just the other day. Matthew came home from Halloween with a pillowcase full of candy, like sugar coma candy. Okay? And so being the giving dad that I am, I thought I'd help him out with it. And so we started into a negotiation, you know? And I said, I'd like a little bit of candy, Matthew. He's like, well, I worked and I got it. I don't think I should have to share it. So, well, you're going to give me candy. And he's like, no, I'm not. I said, well, then fine, you don't get any food. Right? I worked, I got the food, I put it in the fridge. If that's the way things are going to be, I can pull the trump card. We're not negotiating as equals here. Matthew doesn't get to tell me how I should be. Doesn't get to determine what I think is fair. When we try to shape and form and fashion God in our own image, life feels meaningless and vain. Look, I realize we're not there yet. We're only at Ecclesiastes chapter 5. There's still 6-7 more chapters. So far, this answer may seem unsatisfactory. But I think part of that is just, it's not because we're not at the end of the book yet. I think part of that is because of the nature of the answers that we want. When we feel like life is in vain and the meaning is unknowable, when we feel like we're on the brink of that, what we want is a Chapters Indigo Oprah spirituality. What we want is a checklist that's so simple that we say, oh, if you want a meaningful life, just do that. That and that equals meaningful life. That's not the way life works. It's a lot more complicated than that. Life is a deeper matter than that. And in chapter 5, we're beginning to see that a meaningful life begins in a deep place. It begins with dethroning yourself from the seat that belongs to God. Stop pretending that you're God. And secondly, stop trying to pretend that God should be like you. It's the beginning of finding meaning in life. Let's pray. Father, how rich is your word? Your word doesn't just deal with tiptoeing through the tulips and sweetness, joy, and lollipops, but in your word we find people like the teacher who struggle with some of the same issues that we face when we're honest. Lord, I pray that you would give us such a robust sense of who you are and how you're at work and how you're at the center of the entire cosmic story that it translates into profound meaning in our everyday life. That we have a sense that we find ourselves and find our meaning and purpose when we realize our role in your story, not the other way around. Lord, I pray that we would catch even just a glimpse of that this morning.